From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
And now we're joined by New York Times bestselling author David Epstein, who is about to save those of us who didn't specialize early, who didn't master our art or profession, or perhaps didn't even know what it was until later in life. He has written Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. Epstein marshals a mountain of scientific research to argue that the most impactful inventors, athletes, artists, musicians, and more are those that cross multiple domains rather than deepening their knowledge in a single area. David Epstein joins us now. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's good to have you. We very much enjoyed your book. And, you know, we all know the child prodigy, like in your book of Sophie and Judith, the chess champions. And we certainly would like to start a boy band, put 10,000 hours in and sell records all over the world and that sort of thing. But why did you write this book? What was it that really put a light on the specialist versus the generalist?
Honestly, it sort of came out of, I guess a little bit it came out of my own interest in my own career path and questions I had. I was a scientist in training and living in a tent in the Arctic Circle when I decided to become a writer. But more than that, it came out of my work as the science writer at Sports Illustrated, which I was for a while, and started writing about the so-called 10,000-hour rule and realizing that the science underlying it was not rigorous, to put it that way. And that brought me into public debates with the writer Malcolm Gladwell, and in those debates, sort of, we were invited to talk about the best developmental path for athletes, and I knew he was going to argue for early specialization, get started on that 10,000 hours. And I went and looked at all the data from around the world that actually tracks athletes on route to becoming elite, and it turns out they ubiquitously have what scientists call a sampling period, where they try a range of different activities. They gain a breadth of general skills that scaffold later skill building. They learn about their own interests and abilities, and they systematically delay specializing until later than peers who plateau at lower levels. And meanwhile, I was seeing that science, and at the same time, I was seeing youth sports programs going in exactly the opposite direction. And I sort of said, gosh, that seems important to write about. And also, I'm kind of curious if maybe these patterns we don't expect hold up in other domains. And as I started seeing that was, in fact, the case, I decided there was a more important project there than just sticking to sports.
When you started digging into it, were you surprised that there was so much data on this subject?
I was extremely surprised. I mean, I knew, of course, that people are interested in this question of how broad or specialized to be, because I've been interested in it constantly, but that we also usually just talk about it with pure intuition. And so I sort of wondered, can I bring research to this question so that our discussions can be, not to be the final word on this question, but to make those discussions more interesting and more productive. And it turned out there are a lot of scientists who have tried to get at this also. And so from domains like technological invention, you know, in one chapter in very close proximity, I mentioned studies that look at comic book creators, where the comic book creators who are most likely to make blockbuster comic books are not the ones with the most experience or the most resources, but the ones who've worked across the largest number of different genres within comic books. And similarly, in technological innovation, particularly starting in about the 1990s with the growth of the knowledge economy, the biggest technological breakthroughs have come from people who worked across a large number of different technology classes as defined by the U.S. Patent Office. And so I just started seeing the ways that scientists were trying to get at this question of, you know, when does breadth help and when is specialization better? And so I thought that was pretty neat that there was actually, you know, maybe we could bring science to this discussion that I think is important to almost everybody, but that usually is just in the realm purely of intuition.
If you're just joining us, our guest is David Epstein. His book is Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. And David, about the time that Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000-hour theory came out, I took a tap dancing class. And I've always wanted to learn how to tap dance. And I heard that and I thought, I'm going to have to do this for 10,000 hours to be any good at it. I was so disappointed. And you know, the interesting thing about what you're putting forth, I think it will encourage people to be more likely to take on things later in life, like tap dancing. I think I'm going to start tap dancing again. I was discouraged before.
I think that's a great idea. And also, by the way, like continuing with the sports analogy, the more different sports that an athlete plays when they're young, the fewer hours they then need to make it as an elite in whatever sport they eventually specialize in, because it appears, so there's this classic research finding in skill acquisition that is summarized as breadth of training predicts breadth of transfer. And transfer to psychologists means the ability to take knowledge or skills and apply it in ways that are completely new or to problems you haven't seen. And the broader early training kind of scaffolds that ability to be flexible when you're facing new situations and new challenges. So in dancing, for example, if you've done a wider variety of other physical things, the number of hours you'll need to accumulate will drop precipitously when you do focus in on something.
I'm so glad to know my mountain biking will transfer to my tap dancing.
You're practically a pro already at tap dancing.
Yeah, right. Well, but also, when I go in for knee surgery, I'm probably going to want to know that my surgeon specializes in that particular type of surgery. But again, you even go into the specialization in surgery as, well, tell us about it.
Yeah, that's a great question because, and I try to stop throughout the book at various points and say specialists are important also, and here's how and here's why. And surgery is one of the ones where I take time to mention that specialized surgeons have fewer fewer complications in surgery. And that is on top of just the fact that they have more experience in a procedure, so that helps. But even on top of that, specialized surgeons, even independent of just repetitions, have fewer complications in surgery. So to have fewer complications, you do want a specialized surgeon who's done that procedure a lot, absolutely. At the same time, specialized surgeons also do procedures in a huge number of cases where those procedures do not work. So speaking of knee surgery, like they get this, if all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail syndrome. So they have fewer complications while doing surgeries that people don't need. Particularly mentioning the knee, probably the most common orthopedic surgery in the world is repairing a certain type of repair of the meniscus, which is this crescent-shaped piece of tissue in your knee that people tear really often. And if you have some knee pain, you get an MRI, you've got a tear, it'll be fixed. But it turns out that like about half of people have a tear in their meniscus, and most will never even know it. So in Finland, a group of scientists decided to do a study where they gave some patients sham surgery, which means they took them in, they made an incision, they banged around and made surgical noises, then they sewed them back up and sent them home. And those people did just as well and often better than the people who got real surgery. And it turns out that very few people actually need that meniscus surgery, so the specialized surgeons have fewer complications when they do the meniscus surgery, but they also do the meniscus surgery anytime they see a tear, and very few people actually need it. So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
The write-up on the meniscus surgery is in a chapter titled Learning to Drop Your Familiar Tools, and it's just a fascinating chapter on the Challenger disaster, on firefighters, on torn meniscus, but also on heart attacks or heart surgeons. And you have a heart surgeon, a cardiologist, Rita Redberg, that said that she would often joke with colleagues that at cardiology conventions, they would joke that it was the safest place in the world to have a heart attack. And you cite a study where patients with heart failure or cardiac arrest were less likely to die if they were admitted during a national cardiology convention when everybody was away. I mean, that's fascinating stuff. I mean, how big was that study?
That was a multi-center study, including a number of teaching hospitals and non-teaching hospitals. The effect was even bigger at teaching hospitals, where the real specialists are, and that study's been replicated now. So it's been done twice over a huge number of patients in both teaching and non-teaching hospitals, and that's pretty scary. And you know, to Rita Redberg, to Dr. Redberg's credit, she recognized that this meant something is going really wrong, and what it appears to be is that very specialized cardiologists once they get really attached to a particular type of procedure, they see it as the solution to everything. And sometimes those procedures are not indicated, and we don't really know how effective they are, and they have some complication rate, no matter how good a surgeon you are. That means some people will die or have very serious complications. And a huge number of people that don't need it are getting it. And so when these more specialized surgeons, especially from the teaching hospitals, are gone at a conference, you're less likely to get rushed into getting one of those procedures and therefore less likely to die. And I think that's a pretty – I don't think that means that we don't need medical specialization by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it means that we have frozen out the generalists in that system who keep an eye on the larger findings, on what the science says about the procedure, not just how to execute it, when it should actually be done. And I think that's causing these really perverse outcomes like that.
And what does that say about us? I mean, if they're shown the evidence that that stents aren't always the answer, and they continue to pull that out of the tool bag, and you reference a number of different, you know, the firefighters and the engineers at NASA, and I mean, what is the reluctance to move away from these tried and true or what you believe, perceived to be tried and true tools are? What's the reluctance to drop those things?
You know, I think some of it has to do with when someone becomes so specialized in an area, what they're doing, you know, they have a cognitive bias to believe that what they're doing makes a ton of sense. So you mentioned stents. There have been, for people, patients with stable coronary artery disease or stable chest pain, there have been 12 randomized controlled trials that have shown stents, which, you know, open up a blood vessel that's been narrowed, will open up the blood vessel, but will not change the incidence of stroke, heart attack, or death. And that's what you actually care about. So the people are dying of the same things at the same rates, just with, you know, a blood vessel that's more open. And I talked to some of these cardiologists and said, in the face of this evidence, why do you keep doing this? And the answers kind of broke down to two categories. One was, well, multiple times I heard, well, you don't want a gym fix situation, which was a reference mm-hmm. to a famous jogger
right.
who died, and that had nothing to do with a stent. So I'm not really sure. You know, that maybe is like Daniel Kahneman's availability heuristic, where the first thing you think of is just a dramatic story, whether or not it's even applicable. And the second thing they would say is they would start to describe why it makes sense to do that, to open that blood vessel when it's narrowed and someone has chest pain. The problem is, when you zoom out and look at the complex system that is the human body, the specialists who are looking at what's called surrogate markers, they're not looking at the human. They're looking just at that blood vessel. And if that human were a kitchen sink, then what they were doing would make a lot of sense. But when they translate that to the body, it no longer works because it's a complex system. And so when people get very specialized and they sort of have this narrow range of tools and processes that they are so used to that they don't even think about them anymore, really. They just sort of reflexively do it and it retrospectively fit narratives to why it's done and why it certainly makes sense, even while there are 12 randomized controlled trials saying it doesn't work. So they basically have blinders on to any evidence that suggests something different should be done.
It's human nature to fall back on what we know. And if what we know is very narrow, then we're always going to fall back on that. It kind of makes common sense what you're saying. I know a young man who went to a very academic, small liberal arts college, and he wanted to get a computer science degree. And about his junior year, he starts lamenting to his parents, "Why did you support me in sending me to this liberal arts school? The computer science program isn't strong. I should have gone to a technical school." Then he gets his first job. He's going to be a software development engineer. And again, he laments, "I know nothing as I start my job. I should have gone to a technical school." And then about 2 years into his career at Amazon, he says, "You know, I'm really glad I went to that liberal arts school, because all of the, project management and writing that I have to do and all that, it really complements. And I learned the other stuff on the job." That young man, of course, is my son. And it just, you know, everything that you're saying is, I ought to just send him this book.
I think you're getting actually at... that's a funny story, but I think it actually gets at, to me, what is one of the deeper themes that runs through just about every chapter of Range, which is that for me is deeply counterintuitive, or was, and still even his, having written the book sometimes, that things that you can do that cause the greatest apparent progress in front of your eyes, like if you're going to be a programmer, that you should start doing programming immediately, or if you're going to be, you know, a basketball player, you should do only that immediately, that to be the best at X, you should start doing only X as soon as possible, turns out not to be right, and actually the things that you can do that cause that most rapid short-term development can actually undermine your long-term development. I mean, that's an explicit topic in Chapter 4 about learning, where the things that cause the fastest improvement, you know, in the classroom actually undermine later development. But I think that's really one of the themes of the book, that we get fooled by our intuition to take the most direct path, even when developing the best 10-year-old or 20-year-old isn't the same as developing the best 30-year-old or 40-year-old.
Yeah, and that's why young people shouldn't, there's so much pressure now to know what you're going to do when you're in high school, you know, what you're going to study in college. And back when I was in college, it seemed like there wasn't that kind of pressure that I didn't know what I was going to do. Maybe in some ways I still don't, but getting a lot of background knowledge along the way certainly has made me have a good time in life.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea what I'm going to be when I grow up. I really don't know what I'm going to, I left my job to finish this book. But I was super goal-directed as a teenager. I knew I was going to go to the Air Force Academy and be a test pilot and be an astronaut. Of course, I didn't do any of those things. And now I've almost gotten, like, linearly less goal-directed. But I realized that I fit perfectly with the research in the book called The Dark Horse Project, where people who find careers that really fit them do this sort of short-term planning and zigzagging and adjusting to opportunities and not looking around and saying, here's someone younger than me who has more than me. But they say, here's who I am right now, here are my skills and interests, here are the opportunities in front of me, I'll try this one, and maybe a year from now I'll change because I will have learned something about myself. And that's how they go about optimizing their match quality, that fit between who they are and what they do. And they sort of become generalists through that zigzagging, not because they set out to say, like, well, I'm going to be a generalist. But that's kind of what's happened to me. You know, I never would have guessed that, you know, being in grad school for geology would be what set me apart at Sports Illustrated, where everyone was waiting in line, you know, to be the next beat reporter for whatever sport. And I had this odd background that allowed me to sort of leap over them because I was bringing a skill that was ordinary in one domain to another domain where suddenly it was extraordinary. And everywhere I've zigged and zagged, that's kind of been the source of power and advantage for me.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with David Epstein. He has written Range: Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. One of the other things that you said in the book, which I just thought was fascinating, was that as the specialists narrow their view, the opportunities for the non-specialists to help them becomes more abundant. Tell us about Alf Bingham.
Alf Bingham was a fun interview because he started the interview by saying, look, I'm an organic chemist. I'm so specialized that if it doesn't have a carbon in it, I'm technically not even qualified to look at it. So he acknowledged his own specialization, but he was a chemist who rose up to become the VP of Research and Development at Eli Lilly. And in that process, what he started to realize was that as researchers at Eli Lilly were becoming increasingly specialized, they were increasingly getting stuck. So the business literature uses the terms exploration and exploitation. Exploration means your search for new knowledge and novel solutions to problems. And exploitation is sort of, once you have an area of knowledge, how to get the most out of it. And what he realized was that exploration phase, where you find new things or new solutions, was increasingly residing outside of the specialist's view because they were all getting so narrow. That they were good at the exploitation part, but not at the exploration part. And so they were getting stumped by a lot of problems. And so Alf said, why don't we put them online and see if anyone else can help? Since he had noticed that a lot of these solutions would come from some random experience someone had that had nothing to do with their technical training. And, of course, the scientists at Lilly said, you know, are you crazy? We're the most specialized, the most well-resourced. Who's going to solve the problems we got stuck on? And so he sort of said, well, then you shouldn't mind. Like, let's just put them up. And he did, and got solutions so quick to about a third of them. So they didn't all get solved, but these are problems that had stumped Eli Lilly, so having a third of them solved is a big deal. And they would get solved by some, you know, random person. Like, the more likely, what he found was the more likely that a question was to draw a diverse array of solvers, so like dentists, mechanics, physicists, lawyers, instead of just chemists, the more likely it was to get solved. And this worked so well, and blew his colleagues away, then he decided to spin it off as a separate company called Innocentive that just helps other organizations post problems in a way that will attract a diverse array of solvers, and they can post a reward. And the results have been phenomenal. I mean, someone working at a cell phone, retired from a cell phone company, solved a problem about predicting solar storms that had stumped NASA for 30 years using a totally different approach. And now Innocentive worked so well that there's a bunch of spin, you know, there are a bunch of basically, I don't want to call them copycats, but other organizations harnessing that same good idea. Another one that's pretty neat is called Kaggle, that posts challenges in machine learning, which is as cutting edge as you can get, right? It's AI that is trained to learn by itself. And again, the people who will solve a Kaggle health challenge usually aren't really machine learning experts. They aren't really health experts. And they're drawing on some knowledge that you would have had trouble predicting would be essential to the problem. And so I think Alf's hypothesis was borne out in that as specialists become more specialized, it doesn't mean they are unimportant. It just means that the exploration phase is increasingly outside of their view.
Yeah, and I also noticed that you spoke to Daniel Kahneman about heuristics in your book. And, you know, it's just fascinating to me that there are so many things that come up and in your book and outside of your book where you have conventional wisdom or you have a belief in something, but our biases kind of get in the way of looking at some of this new information. Is that something that fascinated you, to speak to Daniel in the first place?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was certainly a fan of his work and very interested in his work. His paper called On Psychology of Prediction that you can find easily free online that I think is one of the coolest scientific papers ever written. And, you know, the reason I kind of came into contact with him and wanted to interview him is because there was this conflict in expertise literature between scientists who were finding that people would get better and better and better with experience and people like Kahneman who were finding that people would get more confident but not better with experience and sometimes worse with experience. And so I wanted to talk to him sort of about how do you reconcile those. And that's basically the topic of the first chapter. And whether someone gets better or not with experience really depends on the type of domain they're working in. And of course, Kahneman was focused on the domain where you do not simply get better with experience. And that has to do with that's sort of the origin of his interest and what became his work in displaying cognitive biases, that really, I think, changed the way we think about thinking.
I just had this thought that there are, 6 billion people walking around the planet with all of these biases and things just aren't what they really are. And that's one of my takeaways from reading his paper.
It's amazing. And I think an extension of some of his work is in Chapter 10 with Philip Tetlock's work, where you see who are these people who do seem to get a better handle on the world and are able to kind of predict, geopolitical and economic trends a little better, and they turn out to be these perspective aggregators, basically these people who are not narrowly focused but go around collecting mental models of the world from people in many different disciplines and essentially integrate them. And it did turn out that those people, they are absolutely not immune to cognitive biases, but they do better than other people do, and that seems to be one of the things that helps them perceive the world in a more productive way.
David, before we let you go, I just want to ask you about, you talk about Paul Graham, a computer scientist and co-founder of many different startups. He talks about a graduation speech, since it's graduation time, that he wrote but never delivered. And it was about the idea that a lot of the jobs that are going to be out there in 10 years, we don't even know about. They don't even exist yet. And so his counsel to kids was, you shouldn't have this dream that you followed your whole life that you're going to follow, because what you might be doing hasn't even been developed yet.
Yeah, and it was totally in line again with that, the findings of like the Dark Horse Project, how people find the best fit for themselves, which is short-term planning and short-term seizing of opportunities instead of ironclad long-term goals. And I loved that Paul used the term, he said, what we call this, where you set a goal before you've really had a chance to experience things and get a sense of yourself and the opportunities, as computer scientists, we call this premature optimization. And I just loved that he drew that analogy. So I thought it was a really effective way to portray it.
David Epstein is the best-selling author of The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. He's now written a real page-turner. It's titled Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. We want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me and your work in disseminating information about science.
Okay. Thank you, David.
Thanks. Oh, a really interesting book. And, you know, there were so many stories in there, of course, that we didn't get to, which is why we should be reading the book. But I just wanted to mention this couple interesting points, John. So he talks about this study that two people did, Todd Rose, director of Harvard Mind, Brain, and Education Program, along with a computational neuroscientist, O.G. Ogus. And they wanted to study people who had taken a circuitous route to become very successful. And they thought, well, we'll probably have to interview five people, and then there'll be one in every five who took the circuitous route towards achieving great success. Of course, what they found out is that five out of five basically took an unusual route. And so they talk about Charles Darwin. You know, he was destined to be a medical doctor. His father was. And, you know, he was encouraged, or forced rather, to go into medical school. Well, at the first sight of blood and, you know, the, as they mention in the book, the saw to initiate surgery, he leaves and he says, I'm never going back there. So he bounces around. He thinks he might be a clergyman. He's going to, you know, study the Bible. And then just on the off course, he takes this, or the off chance, he takes this botany course with a professor who subsequently recommends him for an unpaid position aboard the boat, the Beagle, of course. So as they say in the book, he began the most impactful gap year ever known to man, right? Because after that, he becomes, you know, one of the world's greatest botanists. And then Michael Crichton, the writer with Jurassic Park, he graduated from Harvard Medical School. Did you know that?
Right.
And then he
yeah.
became a writer after that. So a circuitous route.
There's so many different stories. And we also spoke about this before, and it's actually written in the book as well. Steve Jobs, who at one time attended Reed College, which is a famous liberal arts college, and he didn't go to class very much at all, but there was one class that sort of interested him, so he dropped in and sort of, you know, looked at it, and it was on calligraphy, and it fascinated him, so he stayed for the entire class for the entire semester, and he said that as a result of taking that class, he believed that it was a very important idea in his original Mac to be able to put the different fonts and the different size fonts and the different types of ways of expressing languages. And it was all a result of something which was totally divorced from computer science.
And that was one of the early, very early reasons that his company was so successful, is that creativity piece. And of course, from the outside, and you, looking back, you say, of course, calligraphy is tied to the success of Apple, right? But how often can we do that in our own lives, that we say, well, I really like to do this thing over here, and it'll be a great tie-in to what I'm doing. We hardly ever give ourselves the credit for that, and we really ought to. We have to find a way to do it, because it'll just broaden our perspective of what we can do.
And you and I were speaking in the green room before the interview, and we both agreed that it was an uplifting book because we were both, in fact, generalists, mm-hmm. you and I. Mm-hmm. And we've tried a number of different things in our careers and lots of different types of experiences that may be unrelated to each other, but have certainly informed us to where we are today.
That's right. Sitting across from each other, talking into microphones.
That's right. you know, Lynn, intuitively, we all believe that a poor diet is probably bad for us. But finally, some information came out, and this was in CNN reported just a couple days ago, that they estimate 80,110 new cancer cases among adults 20 and older in the United States were attributable simply to eating a poor diet. And it was reported in the JNCI Cancer Spectrum 2 days ago.
Well, so interesting. And one thing we know is that if you're eating food that's not great in your diet, what you're not doing is reading eating a great intake of vegetables and fruits and whole grains and things like that. And so when you drop the junk food, it's amazing how much you fill it in with vegetables and that sort of thing. And so, really, and that's an amazing study.
And also men 45 to 64 years of age and that were ethnic minorities, including blacks and Hispanics, had the highest proportion of diet-associated cancer burden compared with other groups, the research continues.
Wow. So incredible study.
Yeah.
Oh, and they say eating just one slice of bacon a day is linked to a higher risk of colorectal cancer.
Mm.
Darn.
Wow. Well, in a separate story, and this came out of the New York Times, the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, also known by the acronym DARPA, has officially funded a program to come up with a brain-machine interface in the form of a headset designed to let military personnel control anything from active cyber defense systems to swarms of unmanned aerial vehicles through brain activity. Just brain activity.
I couldn't believe when I heard that. I just thought the margin of error for just a little flutter of brain activity. We can't control those thoughts that come into our head. Attack.
we know ourselves,
attack,
don't we, Liz?
Destroy. Yeah. You know? That's pretty crazy. Well,
so they said just as service members put on protective and tactical gear in preparation for a mission, in the future they may put on a headset containing a neural interface.
Wow. So ambitious timeline for this headset. Well, first they have to figure out a way to record electrical signals in the brain and then how to relay information back to the brain tissue. And once that happens, they're hoping to turn that ability into this brain-machine interface used in this military context, such as controlling drone swarms. Wow. And yeah, interesting story. We'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
All right. Let's thank our underwriters, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Habitat for Humanity Restore, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Remember, you can always reach us. kpcw.org. Go to the shows tab and you can hear any of the Cool Science Radio shows. We archive those there.